Welcome, everyone. Glad you can join us. Today is June 23rd, 2021, and this is our Platinum Breeder Coaching Call. I'm getting everybody in here so we can get started. If you haven't met me, I'm Gail Watkins, formerly of Avidog, currently of Good Dog. If you haven't joined us before, this is pretty much first come, first serve. So don't be overly polite or overly shy. I hate it when people wait to the very end and then try and get their question answered and we have run out of time at that point. I'm trying to think if I have any announcements. I guess for those of you who may be interested, I'm having a discussion with Myra Savant-Harris this afternoon at 5 o'clock. On neonatal puppy care. And that will be live in the Good Breeder Center on Facebook. Let me see if I can pull that up right now. And you can just join us live there. And I think actually there's a Zoom link. So if you give me a second, I should be able to pull it up. And if you aren't on Facebook, I think you can Zoom, but let's see if I can find it. Probably not. I may have to do it a little bit later. There we go. See if this link works. So I'm just put it in the chat to everyone. It's a really long link, but see if it gets you there. And it'll just be a Facebook Live. So, you know, you can come and go, ask your questions, etc. Terrific. Okay, we'll get started on your questions. So it looks like Sarah Gaines is first. I did have a few mailed in to me. So we'll talk about those we'll sort of insert them into the conversation. So Sarah says Pirouette's puppies turned 4 weeks yesterday. She's extremely protective of her puppies when it comes to the other dogs in her home. I want to move the puppies to our living dining room area. You had sent this in, I think, to me, Sarah. I don't know if being more open space is going to help her relax a little bit or make things worse. I've been working with her to show her puppies are safe even when the dogs walk past, that I'm not home during the day and won't be able to mediate. Sarah, can you unmute?
Okay.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, good, how are you?
Good. Yeah, this is a tough challenge. Typically between 3 and 4 weeks, bitches become less protective. How is she responding when the dogs walk by?
So right now she's in our guest bedroom, which is kind of at the end of our house. And if the dogs even like go down the hallway, she like barks and like runs at them, like snapping at them. And so
she is charging them.
Yeah.
So we would expect that would begin to decline over the next week. If she were my dog, I would not move the puppies until I see that lessening. Okay. I can always bring the puppies out or let the other dogs in when she isn't there.
So but I don't know if I made a mistake, but on Sunday, I did, like, I just put her in the bedroom with my husband, and then I brought the puppies in, or the dogs in, my dogs in, to just see the puppies, like, one at a time, and Pirouette, she came out of the bedroom with my husband, went and started, like, whining and whimpering and, like, sniffing around, and then she ran out and, like, was, like, snarling at my other female who had been in that room and was very like upset, like knew that she had been in there and was not happy about it.
Yeah, so there really is no need for the other dogs to interact with the puppies okay. if she's having such a strong reaction to them. They're only okay. 4 weeks old. They're mm-hmm. She knows they're still really helpless. They've okay. had an interaction with them, and clearly it's stressing her out. And yeah. the challenge we always have is as we stress the bitch out, she ends up with cortisol in her milk. That gets passed on to the puppies. Mm-hmm. In addition, she's just not going to mother as well because she's now hypervigilant or she's really okay. concerned. So I would give her a little bit more time. Obviously, okay. we would love the puppies to get a little more stimulation than, you know, they're able to in a small room. But you can work on that with noises and things like that. In okay. addition, you may want to simply... I don't know, send her on a drive with your husband or something, you know, like send her out of the house and just bring the puppies out into the living area.
Okay.
Other dogs don't have to be around. The other dogs can be put away, but they now have the opportunity to get a little bit more stimulation than they might back in the bedroom. And then okay. I would keep following her lead. Does she have an adaptive collar on, or are you using calcium?
All of the above. Yeah, she's got a okay. collar. I have a diffuser, and then
okay.
I've been giving her lots of calcium. She did go to the vet this morning, and she has stress colitis. I know. So I don't know if that's contributing or if it's an effect of, or
it's an effect of.
Okay.
Yeah. It. I mean, I guess if she felt really bad, it would not make her the cheeriest dog right. to be around. But it sounds like she's stressed by the presence of the other dogs. So yeah. protect her as much as you can from that white noise okay. machines, gates, so that nobody can accidentally go in. And
okay.
Depending upon, I would play this by ear. You might find that she's better with a gate than a door closed, because a door closed is really isolating for bitches. Right. A gate less so. But boy, if your dogs are going to put their heads over the gate and that's going to freak her out, then don't do that. Or gate it so that they can't come up to the door. But often...
Okay.
when a bitch is really concerned, just the sound of a dog, you know, if you yeah. are a tile or hardwood floors and she can hear their nails on it or breathing, that can be disturbing to them. So
we have carpet and she seems to know every time they walk past the door. So gate sounds like a good idea so she can kind of see what's going on and not just hear.
I think that's really important. And as best you can position the, are they in a pen or a box, the puppies?
They're in a box inside a bigger pen, and then I just let them out of the box like a couple times a day. For
as best as she can see the door when she's in nursing them, so okay. that nobody can sneak up on her. She doesn't have to worry about watching, because she can just pick her head up and see the door and be sure that they're not coming in. And hopefully okay. over the next 7 to 10 days, she'll relax, but not all bitches do. And then it's a matter, does she like drives? Like riding in the car?
She doesn't, well, she seems kind of, she doesn't like highways or, you know, but around the block or, you know, down a quiet road. Yeah, she doesn't mind that.
Yeah, we try to, if we have a bitch that's acting like this, we try to give her something she enjoys. So a walk with somebody okay. or a drive with somebody. Okay. And then we do things with the puppies. But as she showed you, always remember when you're doing things with the puppies, she's going to smell it when she comes back. And so you want to make sure that, you know, so whatever you're doing, there's not going to be that odor that really upsets her. So it could okay. be something like, we're going to go visit the bathroom. We're going to go visit the living room. We're going to go into the bedroom. So the puppies have experiences that don't involve the other dogs.
Okay.
We always have to remember that in sort of the wild, the greatest risk to puppies are from strange dogs, wolves, coyotes, etc. And so this is a really natural reaction. It sometimes amazes me how tolerant many of our mothers are to strange non-maternal dogs. You know, they're not strange in the sense she knows the dogs, but obviously she's not feeling like it's a safe situation. And we don't have to even think that the other dogs are doing anything inappropriate. This is just maternal instinct.
Okay. Thank you. That helps a lot. I Avidog is just one of the puppy programs I use. And the other one was saying like, oh, it's really important for them to be introduced to other dogs. And so I was kind of feeling like they need to meet all these dogs and they need to, so that helps to relieve that worry.
Yeah, there is no need for them to meet another dog at 4 weeks of age.
Okay.
If they can meet another dog, the greatest stimulation that they get from that is an odor change, just a different dog smell. But actually engaging with another dog, there is absolutely no reason.
Okay.
And especially when there's a risk involved. So if you have a mom that's welcoming the other dogs in or actually willing to give them away to anybody who might show up, then in those cases, there's no risk. But when there's a risk, it's not worth it. They can meet other dogs when they're 7, 8, 9, 10 weeks old, perfectly fine. They're not missing anything.
Is there a point that I should start to be concerned if she's still exhibiting these behaviors?
The only concern I would have is that it's just going to limit your ability to do things with the puppies. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be concerned for her. There's no evidence that there is a problem here. As her maternal hormones go down, whether it is over the next 10 days or whether it's after the puppies go home, they're going to go away. Are you keeping a puppy?
No.
Perfect. Puppies are going to go. Her maternal hormones will calm down. I would be cautious with the other dogs in your house as you're reintegrating her, just to make sure all those hormones are gone. And she, you know, because sometimes they'll protect the room. Sometimes they'll protect the box. Sometimes they'll protect the mats. And so if she were mine and I was still seeing this behavior at 8 or 9 weeks, when those puppies go, I would take away everything that they interacted with. So she has nothing left to protect and she can become part of the family again. So no worries for her. The only obvious challenge is you have to manage the other dogs who I'm sure are super curious and would really like to be involved. You have to manage being in two places at one time, which breeders seem to have to do a lot. And you have to manage, how do I stimulate these puppies while still keeping her calm and comfortable and not, you know, not breaking her trust.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you. That really helps me a lot.
Good luck, Sarah.
Thanks.
Sarah Hartwig. Hi, Sarah. Wanted to discuss, and I think Mary's on, so this will be a good discussion. I think she is. Of normal presentations of puppies during whelping, tight cords, when to pull, etc. So I'll just talk briefly about normal and abnormal presentations. And then Mary obviously had a lot of experience with her most recent litter, so I'll let her chime in. So a lot of times breeders get concerned when they have breech puppies. So we have head first presentation, we have rear first presentation, but in both presentations, these are both normal. There's 60% head first, 40% tail first. But in both cases, if you can see my screen, hang on, let me spotlight myself. There we go. So if you can see my hand, this is the puppy's spine. This is the bitch's spine. That's normal presentation. head first, rear first, doesn't matter. When do we run into problems? When we have this and the puppy is belly up to the bitch's spine. That is a serious issue and one that's probably going to require some sort of turning. The other challenge that we will often have, and you might have experienced it, is when there's a foot, a leg, a shoulder. So typically the puppy sort of dives out head first, or rear legs are tucked, tail's there, and they sort of slide out butt first. But if a leg is off to the side, so you have a leg catching or a shoulder catching on the birth canal, now you have a problem. And that's where the wheelbarrow and the woods maneuver become so important. One last thing before Mary and I discuss it. My niece is becoming a midwife, and some of you may be midwives, but she had sent me quite a few articles on how in humans, babies in the mother's body turn the baby. They physically turn the baby prior to birth, and they're not totally sure how this happens. This has not been studied in dogs at all, because a lot of times people will shoot an x-ray and go, oh no, this puppy's not going to get out. But that x-ray is usually done 6 days prior to birth. And we don't know if during those 6 days, the puppies actually might turn, sort of a negotiation between the bitch's body and the puppy's body. Puppies don't have quite as much room if they're in a large litter, because they're all packed in there. And so, if I want to turn, Sarah may be in the way. I don't know if that's the case. It was, as I was talking to my niece about it, I'm like, we have to study this in dogs, because this is an issue for us in dogs. And we don't really know what normal presentation looks like 6 days out. What does a puppy look like as it's entering or preparing to enter the birth canal? Okay, those are normal and some issues. Mary had a different experience. So Mary, if you want to unmute and talk about.
Hi.
Hey. Well,
I will add on the breech thing. The doctor who delivered our boys delivered my husband. And 4 days before my eldest was born, he says, oh, baby's breech. And I just went all well-eyed. He goes, don't worry about it. You're tall. I deliver breech babies all the time. Fortunately, Chris turned around, delivered normally. Which the doctor wasn't surprised, but he had a lot of experience and knew that this would happen. So fast forward to puppies.
And Mary, just an aside, breech in human beings is a bigger challenge than breech in dogs.
Yeah.
So a lot of times we come into a whelping with that human understanding. And so it's a little scary.
I get half puppies hind feet first, half puppies front feet first. And it's all normal. And usually what I will see is the body part presenting with a tight sac over it, that everything's being squeezed out at the same time. At times when I've had two puppies trying to rush the birth canal together, sometimes I will see just the presentation of a part of a sac, not a full sac with dark fluid, like a puppy that is dissolved, and is, you're delivering an empty sac with a placenta and no more puppy, but just an empty or just sac with
bubble,
its clear fluid,
like a bubble.
Yeah. Like she's blowing a bubble out of her vagina. And in the past I do, woods maneuver that gets the puppies jostled a bit. And then pretty soon one puppy will come out. Fanny's last litter, when that happened, the one puppy came out and I turned around and two more were out. So apparently three were rushing to get out. But with Star, when this happened at first, I did woods maneuver and then I had a foot and I took a picture of it and posted it.
It's a great picture.
And you know, and everyone, oh, the foot's so cute. But I look at the picture and I know the puppy's not moving. And the sac is being pushed because it can be moved by the contractions. And so when the puppy, you know, I reached up and felt, and I could feel that the cord was tight, like a really, like a guitar string tight. And so I pushed back on the puppy a little bit to try to relieve the pressure. And as the puppy came down, when I could get my hands in enough with the forceps, I clipped close to the belly button to take the pressure off of the puppy's abdomen. And then as soon as I could, I clipped the cord. I think on that first one, I just, you know, squeezed with my fingernails to get it to sever and get the puppy out. And that was how it went. And I went back through my notes, and over half of the puppies delivered that way without their placenta. And I was really, you know, I've never had that happen. I've had it happen every once in a while where a puppy will come out and they're still attached, but then pretty soon the placenta comes. But it just seemed obvious to me that the placentas were not detaching like they should be at that point during the delivery. So when I called the repro vet on Monday and left a message, I just let them know that I had questions for him. And his response was that there's an enzyme that's released by the bitch, which helps to facilitate that releasing of the placenta, because normally the puppy comes out, the placenta comes with the puppy. In Siggy's puppy, I was amazed. She had some that delivered with the placenta still wrapped around them. And I should have taken a picture of that because that was really cool.
It's pretty amazing.
But in this case, it was, you know, just obviously they weren't coming. And I did manage to get a vet to meet me in the parking lot and give me some oxy so I could get the rest of the placentas delivered. But what the vet said was that sometimes bitches don't get things in order. Sometimes the enzyme doesn't release. And sometimes the litter is so big that puppies start coming a few hours before the placentas get their enzyme and start releasing. And I did notice that she had better contractions at the end of her delivery than she did at the beginning. That just definitely really good, you know, the last six puppies, really good bearing down contractions. And her stamina was great the whole time. I was exhausted, and I'm not used to 10-hour deliveries. But that was what we had. I mean, it took 10 hours to get all 14 puppies out. But I think that it would have been faster had the placentas separated. But also, that also in turn provided a little more protection to the puppies because they were still tethered to a working placenta before they came out. And so it wasn't till they got down to the end that they got at risk because the placenta was so tight against the abdomen. And one of the things that Dr. Christensen said that sometimes if a breeder isn't aware this is happening, the bitch will turn around and grab the puppy and pull on it because it's uncomfortable and actually rip the abdomen apart. And so that was, you know, he was asking me, well, what did you do? And I felt like I was being tested. But I said, well, I kind of pushed back on the puppy to relieve the pressure. And he said, and what did Star do? And I said, well, we didn't let her near the puppies until they were out and separated. And then we let her clean them. The puppies were all born, except for one, they were all born just screaming. And then that one, it only took a few rubs and she was, very vocal as well. So it was, you know, 35, 37, count up 36. I don't know how many years now at this point. It's one I haven't seen before. So I definitely had questions for him and I was so tired. I forgot to ask what's the name of the enzyme. That's on my list. I need to remember to ask. So do you know, Gail, what the name of the enzyme is?
So I don't. I did, after your post, look it up and I found information in cattle because this happens in like 3% of cattle births, and according to the research, and they are talking about the release of a hormone, and I think it's a corticosteroid. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it, we know that puppies release cortisol. Cortisol triggers the onset of whelping. So you wonder if there's a relationship there. But, you know, aside from human beings, the most studied species on Earth for reproduction are cows, and yeah. They don't know.
Yeah,
they don't know. It's an issue. They know it's an issue. So an interesting thing that they are pursuing, that the research are pursuing, is that it is related to the MHC, the major histocompatibility complex. So in dogs, it's called the DLA. It's mm-hmm. It's part of the immune system.
Okay.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting.
She had the miss last year, and the vet thought that maybe there was something about her that was not compatible with that male. The only way to know is to try her with another male. She pretty much cleared up that she's fertile with
14 puppies. 14 puppies, for those of you who haven't followed the litter.
Yeah.
I think she checked the fertility block.
Yes, with an exclamation point, she did. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. That is interesting. I'm going to write that down.
And so does she by chance have some really unusual DLA, which is a set of genes that are related to immune system? This is the set of genes that UC Davis looks at when you do genetic diversity.
Yeah.
So they're looking at DLA1 and I think DLA2 genes, which are these groupings.
Right. Well, you know, and I have her least, so I don't have that information, but I can get it.
Yeah, you can just do the swabs if you want to pay for it and send it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in some way, does she have this really unusual and perhaps super valuable, because we have a breed that doesn't have a lot of variation in our DLAs? And is somehow that not compatible with all the males the two males you've chosen thus far?
I
don't know.
I'll have to look at my notes because we have three males chosen so far, because when he found out where I was going and that I had opportunity to breed to two males who were not related to each other and not related to the sire that she missed with, he said, that's a good way to test. I would be interested when DNA should be back next week. I suspect it's all the younger male, because the older male just couldn't get his business going on day four. The younger male did, and I suspect he has all the puppies. However, as soon as you assume with the dog, you know you're wrong.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. They'll prove you wrong.
But I wonder if I have the same, if there's a mix with certain puppies separating and certain puppies not, because some of them delivered fine. You know, they came, the placenta came, everything was normal. And then some of them were stuck. So I guess we'll find out next week when I get the DNA back. And, I'm hoping that it's all one and it's just was an expensive pretest, but you know, they're dogs. And so we just wait and see. But that would be interesting if I have the same ratio, because I don't have, no, I should have in my notes which puppy was stuck to the placenta was stuck and which puppy delivered with the placenta. I do have that in my notes. So I would be able to tell. And the two males are not related to each other. I was just going to take her to the same male that Siggy, her full sister, bred to, because I figured if her full sister was compatible, maybe she is. But when the repro vet, you know, when we had our visit, our pre-breeding visit, getting everything going, you know, this was something that we talked about. And he said, you know, if I could do her to two sires, then it would just, if she missed with those two sires, then we would know that it was her. And so, yeah, but it's not her. Yeah, because the sire last year, 3 weeks later, he sired a litter of 13. So it, you know, it just looks like it was an incompatibility. And I'm not, you know, I'm not worried about going back and trying to get a repeat breeding or anything like that. I just, my stud fee deposit is just, I'm not worried about that. It's gone, and I'm good. You know,
sometimes so, you just walk away from them.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't want to keep chasing it down. Our timing was perfect. She bred on LH4 and 5, two very, very nice ties. And the last one, her progesterone had gone over 20. I mean, she was everything was tested and it was solid and it should have taken and it just didn't.
So, sometimes the universe does us favors. We just hard to see.
Oh, I'm good with that. I mean, that, that sire has been used a lot. And, the two that, you know, we used on this have not been used as much. And so that just gives us more genes to pull from, but I will run that on her, UC Davis diversity just to see and to compare it to her sister.
I did find it. It's corticotrophin is the name of the hormone. It's the placental release hormone, but it's not well understood.
Yeah. And that was kind of what he said. And then of course the bitches don't read the book.
It's interesting as you describe it, because some of you, if you've bred for a while or perhaps not, have had the experience where the puppy gets out and you can feel that really, really tight cord. It's a different cord than you can otherwise. And if you go and placenta stays in, puppy's like up against the vulva, crammed up against the vulva, you separate them and you can just use your fingernails. It's perfectly fine to just shred the cord with your nails and you're less likely to get bleeding if you do that. And boom, that placenta's gone.
Yeah, it just pops right back.
It just goes right back in again. Mm-hmm. And that it's not unusual. It's not the most comfortable thing in the world to happen, but it isn't that uncommon. It just usually doesn't happen with so many puppies at a time. So I'm going to pay more attention to it in my future whelpings.
And one of the things that I wondered about was if the placentas, you know, as puppies start cramming down, sometimes a placenta gets held up behind another puppy. And then when that puppy delivers, it delivers with its placenta and the one before. Yep. We just weren't seeing that. And we were seeing long delays between puppies. And I just, you know, as I checked with the Doppler, as she got down to 12, and Tim's like, oh, I think she's done. Look how relaxed she is. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Cause I'm feeling her and I can feel some hard spots and I have her stand up and I palpate with her standing and it's like I can still feel some firmness that feels like we have something in there, but it didn't quite feel like I was feeling a full puppy. And so when I listened with the Doppler, I had a 196 and a 208 whoosh whoosh whoosh, faster than that, and but it wasn't like the heartbeat. When you're right over the heartbeat, it sounded more like a placenta sound. And right after that, I had a puppy coming that was really tight. And so I, you know, it just added more evidence to thinking that the placentas were not releasing and the puppy had to, you know, hang on to that tether to get all the way out here. And that cord is just stretched as much as it could be. And so, and then Sarah was asking, just to clarify, you pinched the tight cord with your fingers while the pup was still in the birth canal. Yes, I have.
Which isn't common.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, only a few inches up. I mean, it's not like I was up to my wrist or something, but just, you know, it's amazing how, well, when you have 14 puppies, they're not all over a pound, although there was one that was that big. Most of them were about 13 and a half ounces. We had a couple at 11 ounces, but there was just everything so mushy that I was able to get up and around the puppy and feel and do a lot of it by feel. It's not like I had eyes on and could see, but I could feel with my hand up. And so a lot of it was done just by feel, trying to take the pressure off the cords.
Sarah, was that what you were looking for in the discussion?
Yes, thank you. Because I'm still not exactly, my co-breeder was taking notes and I remember ripping the sac open. So with our puppy that was born DOA, maybe the sac was partially torn, but her presentation was okay, even though she was breech. But I'm just wondering if this was a tight cord and, you know, that's why it just took longer. There was no heartbeat or anything and she was fully formed.
A puppy that is deceased does not have rigidity to it and it's harder for the bitch to push the puppy. And so it's like when I've had empty sacks that have the brown mushy stuff in it with attached to a placenta, but no more puppy. Those are really hard for a bitch to deliver too. But a puppy that is alive with a good heart rate is easier for her body to push against to deliver. Just
She was alive before this puppy. It was the birth process, because when I did the Dealey catheter, there was just tons
of
liquid that I was getting out.
So she breathed
amniotic fluid.
No oxygen in the amniotic fluid, unfortunately. Nothing that they can get to. So it is, the more you do it, the more you see.
And it's a really important aspect on why most of us recommend being extremely cautious with oxytocin. Yes. And because oxytocin is going to cause the release, although Mary, it might have helped you.
It might have helped.
I hadn't even thought about that.
But see, and I did think about that, but we, 3 weeks prior, our local emergency vet, which is 35 minutes to the north, was going to be open for the weekend. When I called on Friday to say, looks like we're going to have our temperature drops down, I'll be, you know, confirming it later tonight. Oh, we don't have a vet on call this weekend. And so as long as you need help between, 9 and 5, we're good to go. And even with all these years of experience, I felt naked. So I called Chico, which is an hour and a half south, and we're mandatory spay on a C-section. And I'm like, that's not in the best interest of the bitch. Well, that's how our vets do it, ma'am. So if you come here for a C-section, she's being spayed. Well, I let the repro vet know, and they got a call from him. He was not happy. In his words, he said, that's veterinary malpractice. He goes, you just don't do that because you're going to lose dogs when you do that. And so now he told me which clinics he would use in North Sacramento, but it's like that's 2 hours and 15 minutes. 2 hours if I go fast. And by then so much can happen. And
why I'm moving to Atlanta for my next litter, literally. I am moving. Yeah. To Atlanta, because I'm not going to be 2.5 hours away from vet care again.
I'm thinking of just packing up my travel trailer and getting,
I would do that.
Parking lot,
I would do that. Oh, yeah.
The dogs travel in it. They know it. It's home. I've got all my food. I got my bathroom. I got everything I need, my bitch buggy toes, which be careful how you name your vehicle. My bitch buggy produced 10 female puppies on the maiden voyage and only 4 male puppies. What everybody wants. They want the male puppies.
I've helped in RVs before. It was great.
It's 26 feet with a pullout. It's good to go. So
Okay, we'll move on. But that was super helpful. Now I saw some questions about Woods Maneuver. So I found a video while we were gabbing. It's quick, it's not really good. So in the Woods Maneuver, you lay the bitch on her back between your legs. If you have a small, so you're sitting on the ground, your legs are out, and you lay the bitch on her back with her head towards your feet. And then you're going to, are you showing us, Mary? I can't see if you have. Yeah, so there you go. She's got the puppy. Can you, let me spotlight Mary. So you're holding, you would have the bitch, she's got the puppy, and then you're going to take those hind legs and you push the hind legs towards her head gently. You're changing the pelvis, the angle. Yep, exactly. That way, exactly. And you're not hurting the bitch. You're not forcing it. So let me share my screen and I'll run this quick video. So this is a little dachshund that is in the process of whelping. So you can see she's on the ground. Her head is up here. If you can't see it, tail is towards the breeder. Breeder has her hind legs and is going to push forward and slightly out. So forward, and then she takes them slightly out. So they just came out there and she whelps a puppy within less than a minute. Boom. That's what Woods Maneuver. I'll run it one more time and I'll put a link to it. So she's pushing legs forward and then out, just gently changing the angle of the pelvis. So I'm going to grab this link for you and stick it in the chat so that you can grab it and look at it at another time. I'll unspotlight Mary, maybe. Maybe not. Okay. So good conversation about the challenges. Now, if you have a toy bitch or a really small bitch, it can be very, very difficult to get your fingers up around, you know, inside the vagina around a puppy. And you just have to do the best you can. You can use a feeding tube. You can try and put lube in just really gently. But obviously, it's much easier with a larger dog than it is with the really small ones. Okay, there we go. Teresa had pups this morning, and 10 pups, one delivered dead. Sorry for the dead one, but congratulations on the others. A question on calcium citrate. Are you still on, Teresa? You want to jump on?
Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Good. A little rattled, but good.
Congratulations.
So Esme delivered 2 days early from her whelping date. It was the 25th. And I figure because she had this big litter of 10,
Yep.
It just came a little sooner than we thought, but we did good.
Yeah, and still in the whelping window. So hopefully they're fine and fully developed.
Yeah, there's three smaller ones, four average and two a little bigger. So everybody's doing good.
I can hear them.
But and funny, when you guys were talking, every puppy was delivered bum first. And the placentas were snap quick right behind them, other than the one that was dead on arrival. So.
It is amazing how quickly they can come once there's space and room.
Yeah.
So question on calcium citrate.
Yes. How much do I give her? Because I'm not familiar with that ratio.
How much does she weigh?
Darn. Well, when she was
ballpark.
Ballpark?
I'm gonna say
about 40 pounds.
Okay. So you're looking at giving her 3,600 milligrams of calcium a day.
Okay.
Now that you can go up and down from that, but that's a good starting point. So you could break it up into 4 900s okay. to get the 3,600. That would be perfectly fine. If you give it to her, the good thing about calcium citrate is it's a fast acting calcium yeah. that doesn't require food. So that's good. But remember, it doesn't have phosphorus in it.
Okay.
And so, you know, over the next couple of days, you don't have to worry about it today.
Yeah.
But over the next couple of days, you'll want to find a way to get some phosphorus in her.
Okay.
And a great way to do that are eggs.
Okay.
You can boil eggs and mash it up and do it with the calcium citrate. You can scramble it. Doesn't matter because you're not going to hurt the calcium.
Okay.
So you could scramble eggs and throw some calcium in there if she'll eat it. Or you can just, you know, we'll often talk about syringing the calcium into their cheek pocket.
Yes.
And then give her an egg.
Okay.
So that's a fine thing to do. You can also, another thing that is relatively high in phosphorus is chicken, but yeah. not the thighs. So okay. chicken breast.
White meat.
Is, okay. Yep, the white meat is higher in phosphorus. So that those are options okay. to try and balance it out. But you don't have to worry about it today.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a rapid problem, but if we're going to give calcium over 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, we want to start getting more phosphorus into the bitch so we can maintain that calcium phosphorus ratio. So look on your container. I don't know what calcium citrate you have. Look on the container. It'll say, you know, 1 tablespoon is 400 milligrams, and they have done the calculation to assume, you know, calcium citrate is only, I don't think 26% calcium. So that's all figured out. You're going to try to get 3,600 in yep. based on whatever they say.
Okay. Super. Okay.
Good.
Other question is, because it's a bigger litter, we're keeping some puppies in a warm box. How warm should that box be?
Warm enough that they aren't complaining.
Okay.
But you want to make sure that the warm box got a heating pad in it or?
Yeah, a heating pad on right. the bottom. Yeah.
So just make sure the heating pad's only on half of it. Okay. So that if they get hot, they can crawl away.
Okay.
I'll and check. get away from the heat because they actually do a pretty good job managing their body temperature if we give them the space to do it.
Okay. Okay.
So, and they may, like if you put a, usually we'll put a blanket over them or something, you know, so we yeah. heating pad, blanket, puppies, blanket. If they start crawling out on top of that top blanket, don't tuck them back in again. Don't put them back in it. They're saying I'm hot. And I need to cool myself off. I usually set my heating pad on medium.
Okay.
And put them in my warming box, which has holes in the plastic. So it's, you know, it does, never gets super hot, but I have golden retrievers with a fair amount of coat.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much coat these puppies have. They may not need, they likely don't need it on high.
Yes.
But more likely medium.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And good luck. Congratulations.
Oh, yeah. Go we've got Annika whelping on the 29th with 6 puppies. So
yay.
We're going to try them all in one room and listening to the conversation earlier and going, maybe not. So we'll see.
I would not even initially, I would not try for the first few days. Okay. Because there's a hormone in bitches that the noise of puppies drives them nuts.
Yeah.
And the noise of another bitch's puppies makes them leave their puppies to go to yeah. that those other puppies. And so you don't want Annika going over to Esme's puppies, because in Annika's mind, she has to do something. Yeah. And now you have bitch fights, you have hurt puppies. So initially, for those first few days, keep them apart. And okay. I mean, apart enough they can't hear each other's puppies. Okay. And then play it by ear and see how relaxed they are, whether you can move them in together. Don't push it though, because the downside's high.
Well, yeah, you don't want the downside. We know what
you don't want. You don't want killed puppies. You don't want puppies stepped on, because the bitches, you know, they get frenzied. It's this really natural, strong drive. Yep. To get other puppies. Now, some bitches, you know, if you look at the seeing eye, the guiding eyes, they have 30 bitches in a room, whelping box, whelping box. Now they're all fenced in, so they can't move between their boxes. But those bitches actually handle it pretty well for the most part. And so they're certainly, we had a litter that I think we put them together when they were maybe 5 days apart, mother, daughter.
Yeah.
And the daughter basically said, my mom can raise my puppies. I'm good. I'm really good with it.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, that Annika will take some of Esme's at some point, because this is a pretty big load for her.
Yeah. And that may well happen. You know, let Annika get her litter born and sort of get everything settled in, and then see if they're more than willing to share.
Okay, super. Thank you very much. And I used a Doppler this time. I bought it and practiced a time or two on a area, and then went, okay, I know what I'm trying to listen for, and then pulled it out at the end and found the last two puppies and went, okay, so we still got two in there to come out. So it was a godsend, because who wants to load up a dog at 4 or 5 in the morning going to Calgary, because we're having huge vet problems here, where the emergencies aren't open at night anymore because they can't get any staffing.
Oh, yeah. I'm hoping this turns around soon, because it's just crazy what's happening with vet care right now. It's just
even here in Canada. So, and the other question is, the Good Dog Live Facebook, is that going to be available for Canadians?
Everybody. Okay. Yep. You can go right onto it's a Facebook page.
Okay.
It's the Good Breeder Center. I'll write it in here. So Good Breeder Center.
Okay.
And it's Myra and Gail.
Okay. Super.
And that's today at 5. Okay.
Thank you.
Cool. Congratulations.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
I'm going to pull out one of my questions. So Cindy asked, I don't know if Cindy's here, I see you. Cindy asked a really interesting question about phytoestrogens. And phytoestrogens are those plant-based estrogens that mimic, or they're estradiols that mimic estrogen. They do it in human bodies, they do it in dog bodies. There is some benefit to that. So it's soybeans and flax, and there are some health benefits to that, as long as it's in human beings that we don't know of any health benefits in dogs, but in actuality, no one's studying that. But there can be a cost of these phytoestrogens on reproduction. And it can happen in males, if they're getting too much of them, because obviously estrogen is not a beneficial hormone for stud dogs. But in Cindy's case, she had a bitch that was spayed and she had a lot of uterine cysts. And in a conversation with her vet, she was saying that there were a lot of foods that Cindy might have been feeding that had phytoestrogens in them. We have talked about this before. It is an issue. It is a possible issue in our dogs. There hasn't been a lot of research on it, but there's a logic to high doses of estrogens going in and causing infertility and perhaps uterine cysts. Now, I will say, Cindy, I just want to say uterine cysts are really, really common in 6, 7, 8 year old and older bitches. So it doesn't necessarily, there may not necessarily be a relationship between the phytoestrogens and the uterine cysts, because I've had dogs that have never eaten a grain in their lives end up with cysts. So I just want to put that on the table. So what are some of the foods that have high levels of phytoestrogens? Above all, the dominant one is flaxseed, and particularly flax meal, ground flax seeds. Flax oil actually doesn't have any in them. And so the oil is fine. It's the seed or the meal that's a problem. I know we have some foods that have it in it and it's hard to avoid because it's added to dog foods. But I would just recommend don't ever add flax into your dog's diet. There are better to add fish oil, better to add just plain vegetable oil if you want to get more fat in. You don't need to add flax. What are some of the other things? Soybeans, lentils, almost all legumes. And, you know, most of us have moved away from legumes because there's not a lot of rationale for dogs eating things like garbanzo beans. And then we had the dilated cardiomyopathy issue come up, and we don't know that whether there's a relationship, but there was a correlation between dogs eating high amounts of legumes. Couple of others, barley. Unfortunately, barley is a really good grain for the dog's sugar. I'll pop myself up there. So for blood sugar, barley is a very good grain, but it does have higher amounts of phytoestrogen in them. To a certain degree, wheat, less so millet. Wheat is typically going to be the germ and the berries, you know, wheat berries. There's another name for them, but I can't remember what it is. But the little, that part of the wheat that looks like a tiny little berry. So as you look at your foods and when you think about supplementing oats have high amounts of phytoestrogens. I know we recommend it for lactation. I still recommend it for lactation. But I would not feed a lot of oats in between breedings. They're good for getting bitches pregnant and for lactation, but then take them off of oats if you can. Cindy, I don't know, you wanna?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, and any other comments or?
No, I think, I have a holistic vet. I have a number of vets that I use for different reasons, and this is not my reproduction vet at all. So my holistic vet, knowing that I really wasn't going to breed her, recommended flax oil. And you had, I know how you feel about it, and I don't have any of the other ones on it. So the first thing was when my other surgeon vet, who's not the holistic vet, said, he felt that her uterus, which was, as he put it, pre-pyro, he said,
yeah, that's pretty common. So that's not at all unusual that these endometrial changes, which cause the cysts, are sort of percolating towards pyometra, a uterine infection for those that aren't familiar. Yes. And for a while there, and I don't know where they're at today, they actually thought it was a continuum from, you know, one cyst to 10 cysts to pyometra, that there was a relationship. Okay. Now we know that pyo can happen without cysts. So there's not a direct correlation, but the cysts themselves appear to be indicative of changes of that uterine lining that can predispose a bitch to pyo. I know exactly where you're coming from, Cindy, because I had a bitch. I actually thought she had a really serious abdominal tumor. Her uterus at 8 years old weighed 4 pounds. It was not pyo, it was only cysts, but it was maybe someday I'll post a picture, but it's, I'll put it in the comments on Facebook, because it was really ugly, really, really ugly. So not necessarily unusual. And that bitch never had a phytoestrogen in her life. So there might be some relationship, but it's not a direct relationship.
I have one other question, because I have all girls of different ages. Besides the one that I'm getting ready to breed, there's a three-year-old that I have that I'm not sure if I'm going to breed. And I just want to make sure that as I manage her diet, I'm not contributing in any way to the cysts. If she happens to be one of the daughters of the bitch that I spayed. So there doesn't seem to be any relation between hereditary and this, from what I can tell. Do you know?
Oh, yeah, there is. Oh, no, there is. There is. Yes. Okay. So there does seem to be a family tendency towards. So okay. Typically, if you leave a bitch intact long enough, she's going to get cysts, you know, at 9, 10, 11, 12. Okay. Some lines tend to have them earlier than others. So one of the lines that I've bred definitely had what I would call early onset cysts. So typically by 5, they were going to have pretty cystic uteruses. So this isn't ovarian cysts, this is uterine cysts. So I would, what do we think causes the cysts if it isn't nutrition? It's likely, so if you've heard Bob Hutchinson talk, Hutch, he's talking about how progesterone changes the lining of the uterus. And he thinks that it is the high progesterone, you know, because we measure our bitch's progesterone, sometimes it's up to 60, you know, really, really high amounts of progesterone. And in a bitch, that progesterone stays high because progesterone is essential to maintain a pregnancy. That's not the case in other species. So this constant assault of progesterone on the uterus is what he thinks changes the lining and begins to predispose bitches. So there's age, there might be some inherited tendency towards them. And then we have some influence of nutrition. But I don't, personally, from my experience, I don't think nutrition's the dominant one. But I think we should be cautious with phytoestrogens.
Okay. And the last question is, in the foods, they're now putting taurine. Is that enough if I watch?
Yes.
Supplement, and I can stay off of all this other stuff they're putting in there, because you had such a great, and I'm sure you still do, an A to Z. I printed it out. It's 60 pages or something. And it was really helpful when I was breeding Haley.
Yeah. So now that dog food companies, more dog food companies are supplementing with taurine because of the heart issue that came up, for a dog that isn't predisposed to dilated cardiomyopathy, that will be adequate taurine, because dogs can produce taurine in their bodies, but we're not quite sure. They have to have two amino acid precursors, methionine and cysteine. And now they kind of think that it's related to methionine, but if the dog is given enough taurine and it isn't predisposed, then you should be perfectly fine.
Okay.
Who are the breeds that are predisposed? Dobermans are one of the dominant breeds that are predisposed to DCM. In that case, adding taurine isn't going to help into the dog food. So you should be fine.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Going back in questions, we got Woods Maneuver videos. Kimberly, I have a bitch that's 2 weeks out from her due date and my vet does not have weekend hours. I've checked our local ER and they say there's not always a vet available for a C-section. It's their policy to spay after the C-section as well. I'm so sorry, Kimberly. Do you have less local ERs? Are you on? Yeah, there you are.
Hey. I do. I'm just doing my due diligence, following your guidance through Avidog. It's her first litter, so I'm hoping that everything will be good. Her mother was very good at natural whelping, so there's, you know, a little bit of history there. My vet is willing to give me Pitocin shot if I need to use that. I am very well aware of the dangers and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, there are a few clinics that are further out that are more like 2 hours out. One in New Jersey, as a matter of fact. So I'm in Pennsylvania, Northeast PA, so I can investigate, but anything would be about a 2 hour drive from my house because I've checked all the local ones.
Yeah, that's the same situation that I'm in. So as Mary made the comment in her discussion, that there is really high risk in doing a C-section on a pregnant bitch. I don't know if you want to spay her, but yeah. It is just not a good thing to do. And it's frustrating to me that that's become a thing, actually. Yeah, if the uterus is ruptured, you know, there are issues. To save the bitch, you have to spay. That's one thing. But to do it just because it's their policy, I totally agree with Mary that it is so unprofessional.
And I agree with Mary. I've got an RV. It's a 43-foot toy hauler, and the back is all set up for the dogs to go to dog shows. So if need be, my husband can just tow me and the dog out to a parking lot somewhere in New Jersey.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you can find an ER, I think it's just risky to whelp a bitch with no ER support. You know, most of the time we don't need them, but when we need them, we need them. And I know, you know, I just had my last litter up here without ER support, and I'm not, it's just, I felt the same way Mary did, that you just feel like you don't have a life raft. You know, you have a problem and you don't have anywhere to go. So I would find, you know, one or two ERs at the 2 hour range and sort of confirm, do your due diligence just as you're doing, and then decide, would you want to make the trip during the whelping, or do you want to move closer with the RV or the trailer and just whelp there? And the great thing about RVs is you can then take her home and there's no transport. You know, you're not moving puppies. You're not taking them away from her, all those stressful things. So,
yeah. Upsetting, but good ERs are hard to find, and good people to work in these situations even harder.
It is really sort of dire at the moment, and COVID has not helped us. It hasn't helped the vet profession, and it hasn't helped us. And hopefully things will be able to settle out in the next year or so, but it's going to be a little while.
Yeah. Thank you, Gail.
Hang in there. Let us know how it goes.
Yep. She's getting big.
I bet. Sarah asks, how long should we supplement calcium for? You can supplement the entire time she's nursing if she needs it. I think that we should be very careful tapering in the first 3 weeks, simply because once a bitch crashes, it's much harder to get her rebalanced again. You know, if we stop calcium or we cut it back too much. So you figure, slight lactation demand in the first week, much more lactation demand in the second week, peak lactation demand from 3 weeks until we begin to wean. And even then, I mean, you think about how fast a litter of 6-week-old pups can empty their mom. It is still a big demand on their body. So if you have a bitch that needs calcium, not all of them do, but if you do, then be willing to supplement her as she tells you she needs it. And she's going to tell you through anxiety, digging, moving puppies, aggression towards you or other people, and just kind of being out of her mind. Just you can tell, this is not my dog. There's something wrong with my dog. And it's often calcium. Molly has a question. We'd like to understand more about treatments for seizures, epilepsy, idiopathic epilepsy. So I'm assuming everybody knows what seizures are. Seizures come in a variety of different kinds. They come in grand mal, where the dog basically loses consciousness, often will urinate and defecate, typically will fall to the ground. Seizure might be short, but there's usually a phase afterwards where the dog is sort of regaining its mind. Then there is idiopathic epilepsy. So epilepsy are repeated seizures. It's usually, I think the criteria now is two within six months. If it's two in a month, it's more. And idiopathic means no known cause. So there are a lot of causes of seizures, systemic disease, brain tumors, toxins, medications. ACE, promazine, is one that lowers a seizure threshold in dogs. So what we're looking for, obviously, in breeding dogs is there an inherited component? Is this dog have an unexplained repeated seizures that might have come from some sort of inheritance? It's not at all unusual, and it goes across many, many, many breeds. Right now, the breed that is being studied the most are Border Collies, because they have so much epilepsy. I'm drawing a blank on the other breed that's been studied a lot. It'll come to me. Getting old. But Golden Retrievers, Labradors, Shepherds, Dobies, basically almost every breed has some degree of seizures, and we really don't have a lot of information about inheritance on them. So Molly goes on, she has a dog from a 2018 litter. Typical age of onset for range of ages for idiopathic epilepsy is 1 to 6, 1 year of age to 6 years of age. So if you have a dog that it starts seizing around a year, highly likely that, or certainly in the window for epilepsy, and then all the way up to 6. So this is a 2018 dog, 3 years old, Australian Labradoodle. Seizure happened at 2, pup had been on Sentinel for a year. Yeah, hard to imagine that if it had been on it for a year, that it was it. Pup had also had some issue with digestive issues, diarrhea, et cetera. Omitted cheese, good success with duck. Since started using HeartGuard and Frontline, neither are known for producing seizures. Most recent communication said her dog is now having a seizure about every 8 weeks, and vet wants to start treating with phenobarbital for seizure control, but first wants aspirin on a neuro diet. So a couple of things to tell owners, at least what I've told my owners if they have a dog that has a seizure, is videotape the seizure. It's very helpful for the veterinarian to see the kind of seizure it is. It also gives the owner something to do during an event where there really is very little that we can do except stay away from the dog's mouth more than anything, because dogs can bite and bite hard during a seizure and after a seizure completely unintentionally. Keep your other dogs away, because it will often get them very excited and they aren't sure what's going on. And depending upon the breed, they may attack the dog that's having a seizure, and it can all go to hell pretty quickly. Make sure the dog can't fall downstairs and things like that. Then mark on the calendar date, time, and as best as they can, because they video, they know how long the seizure was. And that becomes really important, because we're looking for, the longer a seizure is, the more damage is done to the brain. Seizures cause brain damage, and the neural pathway for seizures. So we've talked about neural pathways for learning and things like that. The neural pathways for seizures strengthen very quickly and very easily, unfortunately. And so once a dog has repeated seizures, now the brain is predisposing it to more seizures. So at a seizure every 8 weeks, many vets will begin to talk about putting the dog on medications. There's an increasing number of medications we have, thank goodness. Pheno is the oldest. It is also the one with the greatest side effects. So phenobarbital tends to dope dogs up, and you may have to dope them up a lot in order to get them to stop seizing. Now, often with dogs with epilepsy, you're never going to get them seizure free. But if you can get it to a seizure every 6 months or a seizure every year, most families can live with that. It's a hard disease to live with, but most can. There is also KBR, potassium bromide, that can often be used with pheno and be balanced. And KBR tends to have fewer side effects than pheno, so the dog isn't as dopey. And then there are increasing number of human medications that are working well in dogs to keep them so that they have quality of life, so they're not so doped up they, you know, wander through life stoned all the time, not stoned in a good way, and yet they're not having seizures. So, or they're having fewer seizures. It probably is time to start talking about medication, but my recommendation is that they consider connecting with a neurologist at least for a second opinion. And it isn't so much because it's not epilepsy, it would be more to get the best medications for the dog. So the dog can still have quality of life, owners can still have quality of life. Epilepsy can kill, tends to raise the body temperature. Dogs can be at 106, 108 body temperature during a seizure and can just kill them that way. And then there's a problem called status epilepticus, where you can't get the dog out of the seizure. Usually they have to be tranquilized to actually stop seizing. And then they try and wean them off the tranquilizer. And I mean tranquilized into unconsciousness. And then they try and wean them off of it to see if the brain re-triggers on a seizure again. Sometimes epilepsy is very mild. Sometimes it is life-threatening. And we can't stop all of it. A seizure every 8 weeks is pretty mild epilepsy. So getting a neurologist's insights on, as to whether they should let the dog go on that schedule, is it going to predispose to more and more seizures or should they start medication? I think that would make a lot of sense. Just to give you a story about one of my dogs. So very, very dear friend had one of my dogs a lot of years ago, and she called me and said he had a seizure. Now his was a partial seizure where part of his body was paralyzed. He couldn't, the right side of his body, mostly his hind leg, but also his front leg. Dog was conscious throughout, but completely perplexed because he couldn't get up, he couldn't move. And I said, you know, videotape it, mark it down on your calendar. And she went to the vet and everything, you know, blood checked out, marks it down on her calendar. Month later, calls me and said, Riley just had another seizure. And I'm like, darn, you know, I was hoping it was once in a lifetime. 3 months, 30 days apart, this dog had a seizure. And she realized that it was always within 24 hours of her neighbor's lawn being sprayed by a lawn company. So she went over, talked to her neighbors who are also golden retriever lovers, and said, I think whatever you're spraying on the lawn is causing a seizures in my dog. They changed companies and Riley died at 14 and a half and never had another seizure. So this looking for patterns. Now, would another dog not have seized with that same chemical? Possibly. You know, he might have had a higher seizure threshold or something like that. But when we keep track closely, we can at least look for patterns in what might be causing seizures in these dogs. So that was a really, really, really long explanation. Molly, do you want to pop on? Do you have?
Yes, that's really, really helpful. And I feel like I have heard you tell that story, but I don't recall if I have shared that with my person who's got, you know, a pup from one of my litters.
Worth sharing, yeah. You know, so that they can look for that pattern. It may just be epilepsy, Molly. You know, it happens. It happens in all kinds of dogs.
Right.
But if there might be something that's triggering it, something in the neighborhood, something that they're doing. I had a dog that's had a seizure. And so we started going through everything. And she's like, oh yeah, we're refinishing our hardwood floors. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And got him away from that and no more seizures. So,
Already a pattern that I'm seeing is when I am receiving an email from her is June. So
That's interesting.
And for a while there, I was really on this thread of, I tell my families, do not give heartworm meds and flea and tick at the same time. Don't you know, spread those out. Don't have both of them be oral. I mean, I send information from Dr. Jean Dodd to all my pet families who has for years really been talking about we need to look at those things. And the stomach problems and diarrhea, and she would travel from Kansas to Colorado and certainly didn't want to be dealing with diarrhea and vomiting, you know, with her dog when doing that. But then, you know, I looked at Sentinel and that's one of the side effects with that. And
the thing I find about epilepsy that's so frustrating is by definition, idiopathic means no cause.
Right.
No known cause.
In the yard. She has a shady backyard. And I remember talking to her about that. And then a home visit with her because she is older. She was 76 when she was applying to get a puppy. I did a home visit with her and she's outstanding. She's just a phenomenal woman. She's fitter than I am fit. And I'm not that old. So anyway, I think she's a wonderful parent for this pup, but and is active. It's just, and she, as a nurse, she also is trying to think of what are the triggers. She's actively looking, but I do know from reading about those pathways, once they start with some regularity, yep, it just is easier for them to continue to have them.
Exactly. And an interesting thing, now I don't have a huge amount of experience with epilepsy, but I have produced puppies with it. And the thing that I noted is that when it's epilepsy versus a trigger of some sort, mm-hmm, more likely to happen when the dog is sleeping. Mm. Which I always find really weird that you would think that would be a time that the brain would relax, but seizures happen a lot when the dog is sleeping. So just ask her to track as closely as she can.
I will. And about the videotaping, she has said, you know, it's, and of course I can only, I've never seen a dog have a seizure, but I can only imagine. Yeah. She said it's very distressing. And yeah.
It is very distressing. So if you give people something to do, it is, and somehow, you know, when you've got a camera between you and an event, you have a little more distance than you do when you're just standing there and you can't do anything. Right. So I find that that tends to help people through it. And it is really, it's just an unpleasant disease.
Well, she said that he does recover quickly after.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. They could be 3 to 4 minutes, I think she said, but he recovers quickly.
And great.
So, yeah.
Oh. I'm sorry. It's one of the worst calls you can get, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But I really want to help her and resource her as best as possible. So neurologists, okay, so I'm in Kansas. We would have our Kansas State Veterinary Hospital. She lives in Wichita, which is, you know, it's a nice size city.
Yeah, so I'll put the vet neurologists are ACVIMS. Let me find... So they are part of the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine. I'm going to pull up, find a specialist. ACVIM. On the right of this page, so looking for a neuro. On the right side of this page, it'll say specialty. If you look at it, find a veterinary specialist near you, type of specialist, do a drop down and you'll see vet neurologist.
Okay.
Small animal, and then put in some sort of location.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Good luck. Okay. I hope there's a solution.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I did put in the Good Breeder Center for the Facebook Live link in the chat. So scroll through the chat if you want to join us. And let's see. Jean, question about Flex. Last time my bitch didn't get pregnant, she was on the oil. She stopped. So I don't see much reason for giving flax oil, Jean, but flax oil itself doesn't have phytoestrogens in it, or if it has them, it's a tiny amount. Flax seed and flax meal have a huge amount. So those phytoestrogens are removed in the process of making oil. I don't feed it to my dogs, so you certainly don't need to put your bitch back on it. I think you'll be better off with fish oil or some other oil. Coconut oil is fine, but it's expensive. It's more expensive than, say, just vegetable oil if your dog needs more fat in her diet. Heather says, have you seen any behavioral changes with early ovarian cysts? No. So early, oh, sorry, ovarian cysts, yes. So early uterine cysts, typically not. Early ovarian cysts, I don't think I've ever seen behavioral changes in terms of aggression or something like that. I personally haven't experienced, I have one bitch with ovarian cysts. But what you get is either prolonged estrus, prolonged proestrus. So these are the ones that come in season and they stay at 0.2 nanograms per milliliter forever. You know, for 30 days, likely an ovarian cyst. The ones that never come out of heat and dogs that never go in heat. All three of those can be caused by ovarian cysts. Ovarian cysts are a problem. They will keep your bitch from getting pregnant. They will have a huge impact on fertility. The wonderful thing about them is you can take out one ovary and she can get pregnant from eggs from the other ovary. But there's a huge suppression of normal reproduction when you have ovarian cysts. Can be seen typically on ultrasound during their cycle, during their season. anestrus, they will often diminish, and so you can't see them at all. But ovarian and uterine cysts are two completely different things in ducks. Sarah says, I have a buyer who has a puppy from a different breeder who has some health issues. She wants to discuss the other breeder quite a bit. How do I support this buyer with her dog and educate without contributing to the gossip, or is it possible? Is this a red flag? I always try to direct owners to their breeder. Like if they're talking about their dog, they need to be talking to their breeder about that dog, and that's not you. So I try really hard not to get into those conversations. And I always feel like, you know, I have, it depends upon how many litters you've bred, but I have a whole lot of people that I am their breeder, and I do want to take care of them, and I do want to research for them, and I do want to provide them information. And I would frankly rather put my time into that and send this person to the breeder that should be assisting them. If you want to offer some Google resources or make a recommendation of a vet, I think that's perfectly fine. But I think it's a slippery slope to really get engaged about bad mouthing breeders. Because yes, it may be a red flag.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck. It can be awkward. Eve. So Eve popped on to remind us of this, that Good Dog's having a Facebook Live panel discussion on Thursday at 5 p.m. on rare breed dog breeding, for if you've got a rare breed. So if you are breeding Quakerhunder, or you're breeding Spähunds, or any rare breed, then jump onto this live discussion open to everyone. The link is in Eve's comment. If you need me, if you can't find it, it's kind of close to the bottom. But there's a link there. Just click going, and then you'll get notified by Facebook when it starts. But I would highly, I'll be on that. I don't think I'm a panelist, but I'll be on it. And let's see, Catherine DM'd me and told a story about a vet ER surgeon she had her bitch in, and the surgeon said that they would spay. She refused consent. They proceeded to treat the dog, but the repro vet had them drive to a clinic 90 minutes away to not spay the bitch. And her comment, her question is, are there vets that will simply leave the dog in distress if the owner refuses to spay? Yeah, they'll ask you to leave, basically. It can be pretty grim right now. I'm glad you stood up for your bitch, but it's just not a pretty picture right now about how breeders and brood bitches are treated. Laura says, is it possible to reverse rabies vaccinosis? Two litter mates received second rabies vaccine at 18 months. One pop immediately lost her appetite. The other got a large hematoma. Within a couple of months, one developed IBD, and the other myasthenia gravis and megasophagus. Oh my gosh. She's on a feeding tube now. Both of these issues are autoimmune. Is there anything that can be done to reverse this? Laura, can you jump on? Well, we'll take just a few more minutes. So who is treating them? Are they with an Acvim or?
I don't know. These are puppies I bred. They live in Illinois. And I know that she has top-notch vets. And the mega esophagus one, she's been up at University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Okay. Yep. Okay, good. I would call Gene Dodds on this. I would reach out through Hemopet, reach out to Gene. I have issues with some of the things that Jean does, but I had a litter with vaccinosis and Jean was phenomenal in helping us through it. Absolutely phenomenal. I'm not sure I would have gotten through it without her. So this is her passion and she has studied it. She is a veterinarian. She studied it for years. She may be able to offer you some things that aren't published yet. And so, because I mean, you're sort of stuck at this point, you have two really sick dogs. And so there probably isn't any harm in some of the things that she's going to recommend. So that might be worth you know, her website.
Yep.
Hemapet. Yeah. Other than that, I think working with internal medicine would really be the only thing I can think of. My litter that, I mean, we had 4 of 8 that had vaccinosis to the lepto shot, and it was pretty ugly, ended up, theirs happened between, gosh, it was a long time ago, 13 and 16 weeks, I would say. And they all ended up living okay lives. They were definitely not my longest live litter. But they were able to recover enough, never had another, they were able to have rabies vaccines and never had another vaccine after that. Obviously your two probably should never have rabies vaccines again. So
what, I'm lucky because she's, I think maybe my only puppy buyer who actually has pet insurance, and she's on the little one with the myasthenia gravis. She's up over $25,000 now that it's cost her. I mean, that it's cost. And she has, I think, she has to pay 80%. She has to pay 20%. But she never would have been able to do this and kept them alive.
Oh, my gosh. And they're both owned by the same owner?
Yep. She got littermates. Yeah.
And do you know if her vet reported the adverse reaction? She can report the adverse reaction to the FDA.
Okay.
It's always, I'll see if I can find the link for the adverse reaction reporting. I think it's best coming from vets, but we can do it as well. And they did have obvious, I mean, the inappetence, not so much, the hematoma more significant, because those happened immediately after. The problem always is when these issues turn up 3 months later, 4 months later, a lot of times we shrug it off and say, well, you know, could it be the vaccine or not? But when you have a reaction right after, you can be pretty confident there's something. I'm sorry. Those are tough ones. Those are really tough ones.
Yeah. She's fighting for them.
Oh, boy. Last one's comment from Sandy. Owners are being treated poorly too. One of my buyers was told, we don't play breeder games. If you insist upon this, we'll have to part ways. That was with regards to a titer. The client stood his ground and left. I mean, that's such a sad situation with titers, since vets use titers themselves to determine whether they should get a rabies vaccine or not. And titers have a lot of science behind them, especially the titers for distemper and parvo. Not a titer for lepto, not a titer for Lyme, not those, but distemper, parvo, and rabies are really, now they are current science. And so it's crazy when people get treated that way. Just frustrating as heck. Molly, Jennifer put in a comment for you about whether it's head shaking or whether it's grand mal. Idiopathic head tremors are an option. And partial seizures are an option as well. So, well, I'm not sure we're ending on a cheery note, but as always, it was wonderful to see everyone today, and we will get this video up if you would like to re-watch it. And I hope to see some of you this afternoon at 5 o'clock when we talk to Myra and have a discussion on neonatal puppies. Great to see you guys. Thank you. Bye. Cute puppy, Sandy.